From KPFK, Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the presidential election of 2020 looms large, the many flaws in the U.S.'s current system of democracy come up in conversation, as they do every few years. Primary elections are often flawed and patchwork. The general election's electoral college system effectively undermines the votes of many states' residents. Partisan gerrymandering and attacks on voting rights again undercut democratic power. Campaign finance rules are deeply skewed to allow undue influence from moneyed interests. And still, there are pathways to reclaiming our democracy, as outlined in a new book by my guest, Lawrence Lessig. Professor Lessig is the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School, and he's the host of the podcast Another Way, founder of EqualCitizens.us, and co-founder of Creative Commons. In addition to his many other books, his latest is called They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Welcome to the program, Lawrence.
Thank you for having me.
So I tried to summarize the flaws in American democracy, but there are so many. What are the flaws in particular that you take on in your book that form the basis of your claim that they, meaning elected officials, do not represent us?
Right. Well, so I think that we have to focus on representativeness as the core objective of a representative democracy. You know, conservatives will tell you, we don't have a, quote, democracy. And that's true. The framers gave us what they called a republic. But by a republic, they meant a representative democracy. And it's kind of in the title, that democracy should at least be representative. And what's so striking about our system of democracy is the way we have evolved corruptions in the institutions of our democracy that make it essentially unrepresentative. So the way we fund campaigns makes it so that a tiny, tiny fraction of the 1% have enormous power compared to everybody else. The way districts are gerrymandered in the House of Representatives makes it so the extremists in the states, whether on the left or the right, have more power than everyone else. The way we elect the president with the Electoral College and a system called winner take all mean that the swing states have all the power and the majority of the states, the so-called the rest of the country, the non-swing states, are just not important to a presidential candidate. The Senate is obviously deeply unrepresentative. And the way we allow states to suppress the vote of people who are not in the party of the party that's in power is also unrepresentative. So add them all together, and what we've produced is a republic, a representative democracy, that is in no sense representative anymore. And that's a critical reason that we see this democracy failing in so many areas that it needs to succeed.
Right. I mean, we every 4 years suddenly start paying undue attention to Iowa and New Hampshire, relatively, you know, small states that don't figure very hugely in other, or at least compared to states like, say, California or Texas. But it's because of this skewing of our democratic system. So I want to spend the majority of our conversation, because we do spend so many interviews focusing on these flaws in our democracy with good reason. You have suggested many solutions, some of which are already being implemented in smaller scale to these flaws. Let's talk about gerrymandering, which you mentioned earlier. This has been primarily a Republican project, although Democrats have sometimes engaged in it as well. But it's been stuck in the courts, and the Supreme Courts have in particular seemed to come down on the side of allowing partisan gerrymandering, this drawing of these very creative districts, creatively drawn districts that tend to favor one party over another. How can one solve this problem, and are there models that are already in place?
Well, I think it is important to emphasize before we think about gerrymandering in particular, that we're at a moment when people are talking about broad packages of reform. You know, the House of Representatives in last year in 2019 passed something called H.R. 1,
right,
which was a package of reform that was the most ambitious democracy reform agenda that Congress has considered since the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And it included gerrymandering reform. It included public funding for congressional elections. It included the promise to restore the Voting Rights Act. It included same-day registration, automatic voting registration, and some ethics packages as well. But I think what it reflected most fundamentally is the understanding of many people that there's no silver bullet here, that we have to think about all the ways in which our system has become unrepresentative, undemocratic, and address them together. So gerrymandering is a very clear example of that. People have for many years been thinking the way to address that is to get five justices on the Supreme Court to say the standard should be no partisan gerrymandering. The Supreme Court's made it clear they're not going to do that. And I think that's, in some sense, driving the democratic response, small d democratic response, to say, well, we can do it legislatively. And indeed, Congress has the power in the Constitution to directly require that states no longer use partisan gerrymandering techniques when they draw at least congressional districts. And so what I think is we need to see that reform adopted by Congress, but I would prefer it be adopted in the context of a broad package of reform like H.R. 1 actually was.
And of course, in order for Congress to actually take on such a thing, it seems that we need Democrats in power in both the House and the Senate, since Democrats seem to be the one most interested in making this happen. But in order to make that happen, in order to help Democrats fairly actually get representation in both the House and the Senate, we need some of these reforms in place ahead of time. It's sort of a vicious cycle, you know, or what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, so I actually think that it's not going to be sustainable to imagine just one party trying to bring out about this reform. And indeed, if you look at the state level, the reform efforts that have succeeded at the state level have been genuinely cross-partisan reform efforts. So in Florida, when the felon disenfranchisement referendum passed, it passed with 61% of the vote, which means that a significant number of Republicans and independents and Democrats all joined together to address the fundamental unfairness that a person who has served his or her time for a felony should be allowed to return to the status of being a citizen with an equal right to vote. In Michigan, when Michigan overwhelmingly passed an end to gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering at the state level in a referendum that was originally started by a 20-something year-old on Facebook, that referendum, again, was passed by Democrats, Republicans, and independents. Gerrymandering reform in Missouri has been driven by Republicans. South Dakota has had fundamental reform about corruption. So I actually think there are Republicans as well as Democrats in the states who are deeply committed to the idea of democracy reform. It's only in Washington that you see this incredibly partisan spin around democratic reform. And the real cause for that is one senator, Senator Mitch McConnell, who I kind of think of as the dark lord of the United States government. And he, of course, will never allow democratic reform, small d democratic reform, to pass through the United States Congress, which means that the number one thing that must happen for us to get our democracy back is that Mitch McConnell needs to be retired from the United States Senate by electing somebody who would at least allow reform to be considered on the floor of the Senate.
Just one small issue with what you were saying earlier with the Florida story, though. Hasn't it been Republican lawmakers that have now stymied that referendum that would have allowed felons to vote by sort of reapplying a poll tax? And they've stopped that in its tracks, in spite of the fact that many, you know, a big percentage of their own base voted for it.
Absolutely. But again, I think that this is the difference between citizens and the politicians.
Yeah.
You know, the politicians are always thinking about how do they rig the system to benefit themselves? And, you know, I think Democrats are better than Republicans, but nobody should think Democrats are pure in this either. Just look at the state of Maryland, which is deeply gerrymandered, or Massachusetts, where I live, deeply gerrymandered to benefit Democrats. So the politicians, of course, are not the ideal. The ideal are citizens. And my point is that ordinary citizens, Republican, independent, and Democrat, look at the system of government we have and are disgusted. They think that the system is corrupted. And I think there's a real opportunity to unite people on at least this issue, even though we know that we're divided on so many issues. Here at least is one place where ordinary voters agree that we need to fix the corrupted democracy that we've allowed to evolve.
And certainly your comment about Mitch McConnell is on point, given that he has turned the Senate into a legislative graveyard, just a record number of House passed bills, some even with Republican support, that he has simply not allowed to enter the floor of the Senate, and has, you know, boasted about thwarting President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee. But one wonders if McConnell wouldn't just be replaced by another Republican leader if Republicans remain in control of the Senate. They seem more enthusiastic than Democratic leaders to abuse the traditions and the rules of representative democracy. One of the huge issues looming around all of this, speaking to your point about we shouldn't trust politicians, is the issue of campaign finance, right? Politicians, our elected politicians, do the bidding of those who fund their campaigns. We just had a big anniversary of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. So what are some ways in which that aspect of American democracy can be undone or at least reformed?
He who pays the piper calls the tune. This fundamental truth is at the center of everything we should think about when we think about campaign finance reform. So members of Congress and candidates for Congress right now spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time dialing for dollars, calling people to raise the money that they need to win their campaign or to get their party back in power. But what we know is they don't call the average American. They're calling the tiniest fraction of the 1%. And that tiny, tiny fraction pay the piper, and they get to call the tune. And so it's no surprise that you can't get any major legislation through Congress that benefits ordinary Americans. The only thing that gets through Congress are the things that benefit this tiny fraction of the 1%. So when Congress was considering the $1.6 trillion tax cut, which benefited primarily big corporations and the super rich, that tax cut was defended on the floor of Congress by a congressman from New York who said his donors told him that if he didn't get that tax cut passed, he should not call those donors ever again. So that was the plainest confession that the policy was being driven by funders of campaigns as opposed to any sense of what's in the interest of Americans. The only way to fix that is to have a system of public funding of elections. And the best system, in my view, is something Seattle does, which is to give every voter what's called in Seattle democracy vouchers, which is basically coupons that they use to give to candidates so that candidates can fund their campaigns. Because what we know is when candidates are raising money in small contributions from tens of thousands or millions of people, they are beholden to the tens of thousands of millions or millions of people, which in a democracy is not a bad thing. That's what we want. We want them to pay attention to the people who are funding their campaigns when the people who are funding their campaigns are the same people who vote for them. So that is, in my view, the most important change that we could make right now. It's completely constitutional under even the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United, and it would dramatically affect the corruption in Washington.
And so how has Seattle's system worked? Because we are probably going to be told if we try to enact this at a broader level, oh, there's no money for it, or, you know, we can't hamper the free speech rights of corporations.
Well, you know, the Seattle system doesn't try to silence anybody. What it does is say candidates have an option to raise money from citizens through these vouchers rather than spending all their time in cocktail parties raising large contributions from corporations.
Or wine caves.
Right, wine caves, right. And so I think that what Seattle demonstrates is that when you have that alternative funding source that is independent of special interest money, even if it's not as much as the special interest money, it gives candidates the independence that they need to stand up to the big money. So in the Seattle race, Amazon stepped in and spent what for the size of the elections was an extraordinary amount of money. It wasn't anything to Amazon, but they spent a large amount of money to try to take out city council members who were not as favorable to Amazon as Amazon wished. And what those city council members were able to do using the vouchers was to build a strong enough campaign to resist that onslaught from Amazon and eventually win their campaign against the candidates that Amazon was supporting. So I think that that example, if we imagined it in the country as a whole, suggests that we could begin to elect representatives who had the capacity and courage to stand up to these powerful special interests who are now funding campaigns and actually get representatives who could do the right thing for Americans. That is the most important change that we could make. And I think that's at the center of most of the important democracy reform packages that candidates for president are talking about.
One of the things that you write about in your book that I haven't really heard elsewhere is simply also reducing the number of elected offices in the United States. But if we want to be a representative democracy, isn't it a good thing to have lots of representatives?
No, there's too much of a good thing. When you're voting on, you know, six people to be members of the library board and seven people to be on city council and a person to be sheriff and a person to be comptroller, you know, all these offices demand some kind of understanding and intelligence by the voter. And what we know is we're busy people and we don't need to be exercising our sanction on every one of these types of offices. Obviously,
so do you think it sort of actually contributes to voter apathy to have too many things to vote for?
Absolutely. When you walk into a voting booth and 90% of the people on the voting list you've never even heard of, or if you've heard of them, you've just seen a yard sign, you can't help but feel stupid. You can't help but feel like you're not doing your job as a citizen. And if you don't feel like you're doing your job as a citizen, then many people just don't show up. Now, you know, I think that there are certain offices, obviously, that need to continue to be at the center of our elections, and we should focus on those. But we should not imagine that the solution to every problem with a democracy is just to increase the number of elections or the number of times that we burden or tax the people with making a decision that could more effectively be made by better effective institutions of government.
Lawrence, I want to address an issue that's close to my heart for obvious reasons, and that is the role of the media. Our media are supposed to strengthen our democracy. You know, the freedom of the press is such a critical part of our constitution. And yet these days, it seems as though at least some aspects of our media industry have undermined democracy in a pretty serious way. And some people in office, in particular, of course, the person occupying the White House, has very seriously undermined the positive role of the media. So what should we be thinking about in terms of the role of media in reclaiming our democracy?
Well, I think that's an incredibly important issue because, you know, the book is kind of ambiguous between they don't represent us as in the government doesn't represent us. But then the second half of the book is about how we don't represent us, because the way we get rendered in the media through polling and also the consequence of this fractured, polarized media is to present us in a way that is less than who we are. It's less informed, it's less reflective, it's a judgment that is not worthy of the respect that that is appropriate for a democracy. And the media contribute to that, because the business model of the media is to render us into partisan tribes that are taught to hate and to leverage that hate for the attention and the drive that that produces so that the media can better sell ads. Now, of course, public media doesn't worry about selling ads, but cable television does. And internet media, social media, is designed to drive us into crazy corners so that we are more engaged, because the more we are engaged, the more they understand about us, so that it's easier for them to sell us ads. So this business model, which when it was created in social media, I'm sure nobody even thought about what it would do, has turned out to have this unintended consequence of weakening our democracy, which is an extraordinarily important reason why we need to think about how to improve the media, both social media, internet media, and cable media, so that we can have a public that is actually up to the task of being such a critical role inside of a democracy.
There's also the issue of a very basic aspect of American democracy, which is voting rights. This was something that, you know, many of us thought that in the 60s we had at least come pretty close to having equal voting rights with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. We've had, you know, continuous chipping away at those rights, not just from the Supreme Court, but of course, state by state, with Republicans' claims that there is massive voter fraud and then using those as a basis for undermining people's right to vote. We don't have a national holiday to vote like many other countries do. And as you said, we simply have too many things to vote for, even when we do take the time to go in to vote. And so solidifying voting rights seems to be a pretty simple thing to try to fix. And yet we struggle with it because it seems as though the moneyed elites realize that if all of us had the right to vote, they would have fewer rights.
Well, it's the moneyed elite, but it's also a very basic partisan problem. You know, we in America, for some crazy reason, turn over the administration of the voting system to partisan election officials. Now, I'm not saying that they are, you know, necessarily motivated in bad ways, all of them, but certainly some of them think about their job in terms of how do they make it harder for the other party to compete against them. So look at Georgia. Georgia is a state where the Secretary of State was running for governor, a Republican male, white male running for governor against Stacey Abrams, an African-American woman who was the Democratic nominee. The Republican Secretary of State implemented a whole series of changes to the way the vote was taken in Georgia that threw people off the voting rolls, that reduced the number of polling places in highly Democratic, which turns out to be African-American districts, which reduced the voting time, the ability to vote in advance, did all these steps for the purpose of making it harder for Democrats to compete against Republicans. And of course, it was a very close race. And it's hard not to believe that if they had not implemented those steps to basically suppress the votes of Democrats, Stacey Abrams wouldn't be governor of Georgia right now. Now, you know, it's not surprising that politicians are going to behave in a way intended to make it harder for their opponent to win. That's the normal dynamic of politics. What is surprising is that we haven't recognized that and tried to build a system for running elections that isn't so vulnerable to this obvious partisan incentive. And other countries around the world do that. And I think that's the kind of change we have to adopt in the United States as well.
Finally, Lawrence, are you hopeful about the 2020 election at all? Given all of these problems that we've identified with our democracy, it's a wonder that we have any fairness when it comes to at least electing our president. We didn't yet talk about the Electoral College. This is a very, another sort of skewing of our democracy as well.
Well, I am incredibly optimistic in 2020 because though the media doesn't report this fact, it is astonishing that of the Democratic candidates, all but one on the remaining candidates in the New Hampshire primary has committed to making fundamental reform of our democratic system the first thing they do when they become president. And the packages for reform that the candidates are talking about, including Joe Biden, who is the one who hasn't agreed to make it the first thing he does, all of these candidates are talking about fundamental reform, including public funding of congressional elections, gerrymandering reform, reform to end the suppression of the vote, and packages of ethics reform that would radically change the way Congress functioned. And this is not just Democrats. I mean, you know, obviously the president is going to be the nominee in the Republican Party, but Bill Weld, one of his challengers, has also committed to making democratic reform the first thing that he would do if he were able to actually compete fairly against the president in the Republican primary.
Wow.
So the point is, we have this extraordinary opportunity that's almost invisible to the public because the media doesn't even talk about it. There's been exactly one tiny question asked in the Democratic debate so far of candidates about democratic reform. And so I think that this is time both to be optimistic, because if one of them is elected who has made this commitment, there's at least a significant chance they'll deliver on it. And also pessimistic that we don't yet have a media that realizes that this reform is essential if we're going to get any of the other things that candidates are talking about enacted into law.
Thank you so much, Lawrence, for joining us today. Really appreciate it. And good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Lawrence Lessig. He's the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School, host of the podcast Another Way, founder of EqualCitizens.us and co-founder of Creative Commons. We've been discussing his latest book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at RU with Sonali.